This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. My name is Dan Favalli, coming at you this time without the lifeblood of this podcast, my co-host, Andrew D. Bailey. We are, however, super pleased to be joined by Derek James, who covers the Minnesota Timberwolves for ESPN 1500. He is great on Twitter. You should follow him at Derek James NBA, spelled exactly as it sounds. Derek is D-E-R-E-K for anyone who might have some confusion there. Before we really dive into just some Timberwolves talk, not just about the Jimmy Butler trade, but I'm going to pester him about a lot of big picture stuff. I just want to remind, implore, beg, plead with everyone to continue rating, reviewing, and subscribing to us on iTunes. You can also find us wherever podcasts are found, but iTunes is the best way to let us know that you are listening and that, or maybe even hate listening, but just to let us know that you're listening. Anyway, with all of that out of the way, Derek, how are you doing? I'm sure it's been, you know, just such a boring regular season for you to this point.
Yeah, not a lot going on, not a lot of wins. It's just kind of happening.
I don't want to spend too much time on it because I think it's been killed to death, but do you have any sort of stray thoughts or just impressions lingering from that Butler trade? Where did you think they got a good return under the circumstances? Did you prefer the rumored Miami Heat package that was out there?
I was happy with what they got. I think that adding another versatile wing slash forward in Covington was really nice. And getting Sharge too was, you know, nice because, you know, just a few years ago, he was a Rookie of the Year contender. And I think just to be able to get those guys and, you know, get Sharge even maybe on a bit of a downturn and while meeting a need with Covington, and who knows, maybe Jared Bayless brings something at some point. I don't know. But it was good to see them get players at least fit a need. I know that a lot of these things, you know, it's like, oh, well, that's not equal value. Well, you never get equal value in these sort of things. I mean, you know, you kind of look what the Pacers did when they dealt Paul George. They brought in Victor Oladipo, took a chance on him, and that's been wildly successful for them to this point. And so, yeah, it's hard not to be happy with it, I think.
It's just particularly under the circumstances, and maybe they had better offers with like earlier when Butler first requested a trade. I don't know that Josh Richardson is better than I think anyone they acquired right now. That being said, they don't really have a need for Kelly Olynyk's contract, and I guess having the first round pick would have been nice. And I think you pointed to it. This was the swing piece for me. Robert Covington is fantastic, and he's just plug and play, and so you know he's going to fit. And he, one of the understated things about him is he's a good shooter, but he's not just a good shooter on good teams. There were some pretty crappy Philadelphia teams that he was able to post league average efficiency from beyond the arc on. But Dario Saric is almost the swing piece because, yes, you didn't get a first round pick, but not only was he good during his rookie season, he was really good last year. And it kind of hurts that he's shooting under 32% on catch and shoot threes this year, under 32% on wide open threes as well. But you have to believe those numbers are going to come up, and he might be able to develop a little more of an expansive offensive repertoire in Minnesota, since he's not, you know, you have Wiggins, you have Towns, you have point guards and Tyus Jones, Teague, Derrick Rose, but there should be more touches available compared to being in an offense that has Fultz, Simmons, and Embiid.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to go around there in Philadelphia. And I think, too, they would not have needed the Olynyk contract. I think you have Gorgui Dieng's already, and you're trying to move that piece, you know, just at least get out from another contract, even if he can be a useful player. If you had Olynyk and Dieng, I think you would look at the payroll and, you know, you would feel even less good about it than they might already.
And my final thing on this, the thing I found weird, though, I think Tibbs probably should have just played up the Saric acquisition a little bit more rather than, you probably saw the presser more so than I did, but he was talking about how they were just really happy with the pick that they got, the 2022 second rounder. I think it's going to come from Denver or Philly at this point, and I just don't. Do you think that Philly, like, does he just think Philly's going to be absolutely horrid by 2022, or that Denver's going to be that bad? I if I were him, I know he was probably trying to justify that they didn't get a pick, but I would have really just played up the whole, hey, you know, one, we're going to have more cap flexibility this summer. We won't have cap space. We'll have room under the tax now. And we got Dario Saric, who has another year after this left on his rookie scale, and he could end up being, again, that swing piece.
Well, even Covington's deal, he's owed like $33 million or so until about 2022. That's the kind of contract this team needs. And what you're going to get as far as defense and shooting, you know, every single night. I mean, it's going to be nice to watch Robert Covington and watch him not hit bomb the Wolves with threes for a change.
Yeah, I think after this season, it's 3 years and $36.4 million, which for someone who's an all-NBA defender and hits threes, you can deal with his erratic finishing around the rim or
still just young
streaks. Yeah, I mean, he's not that old. I guess there's probably just a limited upside to him, but even if this is just who he is and this contract doesn't take him past his prime, that's just great value. What do you kind of think now is this team's ceiling that this deal was over? You could call them in playoff contention before the trade. Do you still think they're sort of on that fringe conversation after it? Or do you see this? Do you think there will come a point this season where they will just be decidedly out of the Western Conference postseason picture?
Well, that's kind of, I think, what remains to be seen at this point. I thought that as they were going, you know, they were before the Butler trade, they were playing at a 30 win pace. I mean, if Tibbs was, you know, at that point still trying to salvage his job by keeping Jimmy, because he knows that he needs him to make the playoffs. Well, it's like, well, you weren't on pace to make the playoffs with him anyways at that point. So I think there was just a lot of baggage with the team at that point. I do think it was affecting Towns and even, you know, Wiggins on some level, having that situation linger and everything that comes behind that. And there's probably a ton of stuff that we don't know yet, but it was highly dysfunctional. I don't know, despite what the team says, how that could not have been a distraction. So now that this team can focus on basketball and get back to that, I really do want to see what this team does over the next 10 games, because I wrote about this over the, you know, a lot of players and coaches will tell you that the first quarter of the season, that first 20 games are the most crucial in determining, you know, what kind of team do you have? You know, which way are you trending? You know, despite there still being a lot of basketball beyond that point. And what we've seen from the Wolves heading towards that so far was really, it was concerning. And now they've ripped off two in a row. Key game against Portland tonight after losing one in Portland already. But we'll see if they can continue doing this and, you know, maybe change the sentiment around the team so that by the time we get to the third of the way through the season, halfway through the season, we might have a better read exactly what this new nucleus can do.
Can you see if, let's say, a third of the season is gone, or like they're just 25, 26, 27 games into the year, and they're still kind of just where they are now? They're below 500. They're closer to the second or third worst team in the West than they are to the eighth seed in the playoff picture. Do you think that they would steer into, I don't even want to call it a tank, but maybe to just making sure that they're playing the kids even more? And by that, I mean, you know, Saric, you obviously have Towns and Wiggins. Maybe we see more minutes from Jones. Maybe even Taj Gibson plays less. Or do you think that would never happen so long as Tibbs is still the one in charge of this team?
Yeah, I think as long as Tibbs is in charge, I mean, I think that's going to be tough to see. As far as playing the younger guys versus the vets. And, looking at, you know, he loves Taj Gibson. Taj Gibson, though, played a career high in minutes last season at 32 years old. Taj Gibson does not want to play 30 minutes a game. So, I mean, I think if you have Sarge now, you should be able to bump him back to 20, 24 minutes anyway. And it's not like Sarge is this raw rookie. He's been a part of playoff teams. He has some experience. So I still think, you know, even if you're winning, you're losing, whatever it is, I mean, these are guys you can still play with. Tyus Jones is in his fourth year, I think, already. So, I mean, these guys have been around. They've seen the playoffs. I don't think there's a lot of harm in that. But, of course, you know, he has, you know, Tibbs has his guys and Taj Gibson and Derrick Rose who are still going to play their minutes. And, you know, of course, Jeff Teague, you're not going to scale back the minutes, you know, and someone's making $19 million a year. And, he, you know, Teague still gives you good minutes, too.
I think I would strongly tend to agree with you. The only thing is I was, and maybe this was born from necessity more than just surprise or a personal evolution from Tibbs. I didn't see Josh Okogie playing as much as he has this season. And again, there are circumstances that I think that contributed to that, but to have him be playing, I think it's over 25 minutes a game this year as a rookie, that kind of, again, I know they're light on wings. I know they had the Butler stuff, but that disarmed me to some extent.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are, you know, kind of realizing that Tom Thibodeau is kind of changing his stripes in some ways this season. I didn't expect him to play as much as he was early on. Through the first few games, it looked like Okogie was going to be nailed to the bench for the foreseeable future. And then he started playing, and then you realize, like, this is a Tom Thibodeau player. I mean, he just brings it every second he's on the court. He attacks. You know, he's a ball hawk, just like Jimmy was. I mean, there's a lot for Tom Thibodeau to like here. Even if the shooting, you know, hasn't come around, and it may not even come around this season, I think there's a lot of things that he's going to create for himself and for the team with just how active he is at all times on the court.
Yeah, and he's, and I was going to ask you about this later in the podcast, but he's just been really impressive. And you talk about his attack mode. If he's, I would rather see him take these shots and miss them. And if he's going to give you, I think he's shooting over 63%. At the rim right now, that's good enough for just a guy. If you're going to get in attack mode, the Timberwolves' spacing isn't exactly pristine anyway. And if you can get a little comfortable, we've seen him take some, I don't know if they're great looks, but we're talking about a rookie who's taken some pull-up jumpers when there are stars around him. And that mentality might end up being just really valuable to them.
Well, he takes a lot of threes. And I think, you know, when you have a guy who, you know, isn't the strongest shooter, you don't want him to look like he's hesitating or overthinking it. It looks like, for the most part, he just hoists it up there and, you know, takes the best shot that he can. And I mean, that's how he's going to get better. He's not going to get better, you know, like Rajon Rondo, you know, where he shies away from contact, doesn't want to take the jumpers and defers constantly. That's not what you want to see. But Okogie still takes 40% of his shots come from three, despite him being a 20-something percent three-point shooter. I mean, that's something to be said for his approach.
Well, and that's kind of when, I guess, when you're looking at his shot profile, then it's encouraging because nationally or from the outside, people like me make a big deal about the Wolves' offense in that sense. Mm-hmm. This year, again, they're 25th in percentage of shots coming at the rim, 23rd in three-point attempt rate. They are fifth, according to Cleaning the Glass, in three-point percentage. Is that, do we make too big a deal about that, or is that a real problem with this team that they I know there are guys who are going to, like, that's kind of their bread and butter, mm-hmm. but do we make too much of that from the outside, or is this a real issue that they should be trying to remedy moving forward?
Yeah, it's something that came up a lot last season when you came back to, well, they don't do this, they don't do that, but they're the, you know, the fifth best offense in the league, so it's really hard to, you know, complain too much. And even right now, I mean, they shoot more threes per game than the Warriors, yet they're a less efficient team. I mean, they're eighth in three-point percentage right now on NBA stats. But I think where you get into the problem is last season, because of their volume of threes, or the lack thereof, they essentially started every game in an eight-point hole because they just did not have the three-point shooting to compete with that. And I think that was some of that motivated them to sign Anthony Tolliver this season, put more of a focus on shooting. And I think, you know, the Covington addition will help that. I think eventually Sarge will help that. And all these guys that they brought in to change that approach, because you do have to try to keep up at some point, even if you don't have to overhaul your entire philosophy to do so. I think one thing that a lot of people don't realize sometimes is that the Spurs take more mid-range shots than anyone in the league. Despite, you know, their reputation as a lot of ball movement and corner threes and this or that, they don't really take that many. They just take some really good shots from beyond the arc.
Is there, and I don't want to call him the biggest culprit because he's actually attempting, I'm talking about Andrew Wiggins right now, a career low of his field goal attempts from long two range. Is that someone, though, that you sort of look to as the offensive bellwether, just in terms of the decision-making the Wolves are, their decision-making on shot attempts, on just what they're doing in offense overall? It seems like with Butler gone too, they're going to need him to operate even more off the dribble, and it's kind of pivotal for him to set the tone in that respect. And I guess you can call it improvement. Again, a career low of his field goal attempts are coming from long two, but it still, to me, just seems like there are too many, particularly when you look at his percentage on those shots. He's shooting, this won't hold, but he's shooting 19.4% between 16 feet and the three-point line, which is just absurdly terrible.
Yeah, well, he's never shot that shot well. I mean, even when he's had more volume from that range, he's never been able to shoot that well, which is why it was always so, I don't know, aggravating to see him take that shot so often, especially when he can get to the rim anytime that he wants, or at least, you know, draw a foul and get to the line. That was always the frustrating thing to me, to see him just settle for those shots. And I do think, yeah, you bring up a good point with Butler going. He was a big chunk of that mid-range too. So I think you'll see the offense shift too, with him gone. And hopefully, you know, Wiggins can continue being as aggressive as he was, you know, the other night against New Orleans, and just not settling as often. Because for someone who does use as many possessions as he does, you need him taking better shots for sure.
Yeah, and his I was looking the other day, and his drives seem to be down a ton this year. His free throw rate has sort of cratered, and if he's going to become more,
which is bad because he didn't take that many under Tom Thibodeau either.
Yeah, but if he's going to become more of a focal point, I mean, his pull up jumper has kind of been, it's never been great, and it's weird because he does seem more comfortable operating on the ball than he is off it. I think there's been just some talk about that, where it's, he might just be better as this hub than he is. I'm not calling it old Carmelo Anthony syndrome, where you can't just be this catch and shoot guy, but it does seem like he's more comfortable in that role, and maybe that helps him improve in those areas. But I don't know what the word would be on where I am with Andrew Wiggins. Is, I don't know if it's indifference. I'm not ready to give up on him, but it does. We're talking about year five. Are you still of the belief that I'm not talking a superstar, but that this is someone who can become an above average NBA player and be the, not even the number one, but let's say the number two in a really good offense?
Yeah, and it's, you know, you hate, these guys come in so much younger too. It's not like today I was looking at, you know, Vince Carter's stats and just kind of go, you know, just remembering some things. And he came in when he was 22 as a rookie, and Andrew Wiggins came in when he was 19 years old. So, I mean, there's definitely, Vince Carter at age five was a lot, or in year five was a lot older than Andrew Wiggins is, you know, in year five. And I do think at some point, though, that this does have to turn itself around, because for instance, Shabazz Muhammad, we had a lot of conversation up here about, oh, can Baz, you know, finally become this, you know, three and, well, maybe D kind of guy, or
D-ish,
can become a shooter. And it's like, guys, we've been having this conversation for 5-6 years now. At some point, it's just not in him. And eventually we're going to reach that point with Andrew Wiggins where, if we're still having these conversations, you know, even a couple months from now, it might be, you know, heading to be towards too late.
I tend to give him, or maybe I don't give him more leeway than others, but if I was going to give him more leeway than others, the Minnesota's just undergone such a weird pecking order shift since he arrived. You have Karl Anthony Towns, but then there's the Butler trade, and then there's the whole Butler saga, and Tibbs brought in all these vets, and Derrick Rose is one of them, and he's getting real minutes, and that can't be easy. I know part of the NBA is adapting, but his role has just been manipulated so many times that it seems like he, and Towns as well, but him especially, could benefit from some serious continuity.
Yeah, that especially early on, where I think they had three coaches in their first 3 years. I think four for Andrew in his first, I don't know, something like that. And yeah, with Wiggins, I mean, he's gone from, you know, being the best player on every team he's played for, gets to the NBA, and Flip Saunders says, here's the ball, do whatever you want. And I don't know that he necessarily learned some great habits that year, even though I think Flip had the right idea, you know, play him as much as he wants, let him learn from his mistakes. But he really was able to do kind of whatever he wanted, and maybe sometimes looking back to his own detriment. And now it's like, okay, well, how many different ways can you play? Can you thrive without the ball in your hands? You know, can you compliment somebody? You know, the things that really separate those good players, you know, and the great players. And we just need to see if he can get to that point where he can adapt to a number of playing styles and in a number of situations. But I think, you know, maybe spending the next, you know, 60, 65 games playing, you know, with more of the ball in his hand and having more agency on the court, maybe that'll be good for him and being able to, you know, rediscover himself as a player. Because what we did actually see in that rookie year was an aggressive player whose spin move could not be defended. watching him split defenders with that spin move was so much fun. And then he's just stopped doing it at some point. And it's not as if he was taking hard contact or anything, or there were injuries or anything like that. It just stopped happening. But that was when he was at his best, because even though he wasn't the most efficient, he could still get to the line and still hit free throws at a respectable rate.
And he was respectable, might even be putting it lightly, but that 16-17 season, and I don't place it too much of a premium on points per game, but we're talking about someone who's age 20 season, clearing 23 points per game. His efficiency improved. He shot about a league average clip from three. I just don't think we can throw that by the wayside just yet.
No.
However, I do sort of tilt toward, I don't think that contract he's on is never going to look good. And it's, if it kind of doesn't, maybe do we even give him this year? Cause it might not happen this year. And then we could be talking about them with another coach next year. I'm just starting to wonder how much longer do we wait before it seems like most people have completely turned on him. And for the people who are still clinging to see whether he can get there, is it just, does he get one more year after this one just to see who's in place? Or does it have to be now since he has most of this season?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like next season, if it hasn't happened yet, I mean, because we do this for so long with guys where it's like, oh, well, they were number one pick. And, you know, we hold on to these things that ultimately don't matter after a certain point. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how he starts next season, if there's a different coach and if we're still, you know, having the same conversations. And there's just, this is just likely who he is. And I think one thing that would go a long way for him and, you know, I guess playing up to that contract would be being like someone like Victor Oladipo, where, you know, he can grab 5, 6, 7 rebounds a game and, you know, dish out a couple assists and just, you know, play, you know, increase the defensive intensity, which we actually have seen the last couple nights. But I think the key for him is just going to be sustaining it, not just against the really good teams, you know, in prime time, again, you know, on television. It's going to be that game in Sacramento or Cleveland in the middle of February when it's really hard to care. And, you know, you still have 25, 30 games left and you've already played, you know, 50, 60 games. I mean, that's really where that type of mental focus and fortitude is going to be required.
Something that's also kind of happened with the Timberwolves, it seems, I would say, since around the middle of last season, is a lot of people also seem to have turned on Karl-Anthony Towns all of a sudden. And I know he has his defensive issues, but do you think generally that maybe people are too hard on him, looking at the lack of continuity he too has had at some of what's happened in the offense, where he's not always in a position to get a ton of shots? And I know there's been criticism, and it seems in-house. I was watching a game this season. I can't remember who they were playing, but Jim Pete was just like, Karl-Anthony Towns doesn't want to play basketball tonight. And it just, it sort of just floored me, because I look at him as someone who could potentially become the best scoring big in the history of the NBA, and someone who has been mostly hyper-efficient while not having a constant role, while not really being able to get in an offensive rhythm every night. And we went from, there were people who thought he was going to be better than Anthony Davis in year one, to now we're in year four. And it just, I don't know if it was just a symptom of the Jimmy Butler situation and all those rumors, but the Wiggins stuff I get, the Karl-Anthony Towns criticism or just how hard it seems that people have been on him kind of baffles me.
Well, today is his 23rd birthday.
Happy birthday,
Kat. Just to kind of bring everyone back, because he would have just graduated Kentucky last spring if he had stayed all 4 years. So just kind of just keeping that in perspective is always with him, even though it feels like he's been around forever. A lot of his issues this season, I do think, were a lot of the Jimmy Butler frustrations and, you know, having to deal with that. And yeah, I mean, you do have to deal with that and you try not to let it affect you, but it's understandable that it would, especially when it always seemed like the coach always favored and encouraged the guy who was creating the uncomfortable work environment for you. And he's never been featured in this Tom Thibodeau offense. I mean, he's always played with, you know, wings like Andrew Wiggins and Jimmy Butler who pound the ball, or there's, you know, Derrick Rose who's gonna, you know, pound the art of the ball too as a point guard. You know, he's not really featured in this offense. And yeah, there's some like, oh, well, he should, you know, go and not just sit in the post and wait for his own shot. There's definitely times that's been the case, but why wouldn't you try to feature this incredible offensive talent who's one of the most efficient players in the league? I mean, this guy should be a weapon for any head coach, and he just hasn't really been used that way. And so it's easy to understand why, you know, maybe he just kind of drifts off sometimes. He feels like he's not involved or he's not a focal point. And that just might be a symptom of being a young player. But there's definitely more that the team could be doing or could have been doing all this time to keep him involved and engaged. And I think it'll be good to see, you know, as he gets older. I mean, I watched him closely on defense the other night. And while he had a couple fouls, his one-on-one defense was really good on Anthony Davis, and that was encouraging. I still think that we want to see, this is true with Andrew Wiggins, seeing the team defense get better and understanding not just what switch needs to be made, but what needs to happen next and who's going to be where and trusting everybody. And I think that's where continuity is also incredibly valuable. But, you know, when he sees, like, Andrew Wiggins, if Andrew Wiggins gets better as a defender and, you know, Towns doesn't have to try and cover up for, you know, any of Wiggins' mistakes, or Jeff Teague's asleep at the wheel on defense, which does happen, you know, does he have to play safety net for him? And I mean, or Tyus Jones or Derrick Rose, guys who aren't really locked down defenders at their position. Because, I mean, as a center, you have a lot of responsibility as kind of the last line of defense sometimes. And sometimes it's like, okay, well, if I switch over to help there, my guy's wide open at the basket, or I can see this layup right now. I mean, it's not ideal.
And even if he's – the post stuff, I guess I would get, and I feel you watch them way more than I do, obviously, and I never really got the sense that he camps out down there too much. The times where he seems disengaged more is when he's kind of beyond the arc, above the break, or maybe just off to the side. And yet even when he's just doing that, he's a fantastic shooter. Career 39.1% on more than 700 mm-hmm. attempts through less than four seasons, which is absolutely incredible. Shooting better than ever, I believe, from beyond the arc this year. Yeah, 42.9% on career high volume per 36 minutes. He's doing something there because you don't have all these other proven floor spacers. And it always kind of boggled my mind that they didn't feed him more like that on kickouts. And perhaps that's just the offshoot of you do play around a lot of people who like to pound the ball or go head down drives, not even just Butler or Wiggins, but you have Derrick Rose. So he does seem underutilized. And I'm not a fan of the whole he needs to go get the ball thing, because offenses don't work like that. And the Timberwolves, no. More so than any other team, they're not a team that generates this ton of off-ball movement to begin with. So what do you want Karl-Anthony Towns to do in the half court?
Well, I mean, even him just kind of just hanging out at the three-point line, around the three-point line, you know, you don't want him to, you know, fall in love with that shot, you know, too much. You know, I think one of my former colleagues, he has said it best, like, you know, this should be Towns' side dish, not the main course. But I think even him just being out on the three-point line, you have to respect it. And that's going to pull, you know, a larger defender out of the paint and maybe free up a lane for one of the other guys. And there's just so much that he can do. And I think a lot of what surprises people about how this offense has been constructed is in Chicago, Tom Thibodeau really did have this motion offense that, you know, featured the big man getting a lot of touches and working through the big man. But we haven't really seen that in Minnesota. The offense has definitely been different. And of course, I mean, that was 8 to 10 years ago, and the game has changed and evolved, but it just hasn't been the same. And I mean, Towns he's thriving. He's still an all NBA player. He could still very well make an all-star team this season, and he's played incredibly well over the last couple of weeks.
It's actually kind of amazing that this is the conversation we're having about someone who's averaging basically 20 and 12. he's coming close to slashing 50, 40, 90. He's at 48.2% shooting overall and above, almost at 43 from beyond the arc. Always been a good free throw shooter. And I guess the game has changed since Chicago. And I wouldn't say Karl-Anthony Towns is Joakim Noah, but you can still run offenses through big men who can face up like Towns. And he's one of those,
yes.
He's one of those guys, and maybe it's because they don't let him do it enough, but when he really attacks off the dribble from above the break, I forget how nimble his footwork is, how smooth he can be off the dribble. It still takes me aback, and it probably shouldn't. And he is, to me, I don't know if he's a great passer off the dribble, but he is a better passer than people talk about. He's just never really had that usage, particularly over the past two or three seasons. And so, more so, I guess Andrew Wiggins is going to become a huge part of their post-Butler offense. I really do hope that we just see a ton more from Towns, because he's already an All-NBA player, like you said, and he very well could make an All-Star team this year. And the fact that we're saying that about someone who, on a larger scale, seems like the impression is he's underachieving, that's absolutely wild.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, isn't it? And and realistically, like we might look back on this in 3 years and be like, we were worried about Towns, you know, because he's already so good and done so much. And I mean, we were even having these conversations about his passing and being able to pass out of double teams, I think in his rookie year, when he started really coming on and, you know, defenses were really starting to key in on him and sending help over. And, you know, it took him a few games to get the hang of it, but eventually he started being able to pass out of those and recognize the double teams coming. So, I mean, he's a smart player. He can adapt quickly. And I mean, the thing that too, that I don't think has helped his case is he's talked so much about wanting to be great, wanting to be this or that. And then the habits hadn't changed on the court that we had seen, whether it was defensively talking about wanting to be a great defender. And he heard all this criticism last season. You could tell it kind of got to him a little bit, just being around him, but he's certainly worked through it. And I feel better about where he's at on that end than I did say a year ago. So, I mean, it's really, you know, just how progress goes sometimes.
Is it encouraging or discouraging that his issue on defense is more so team defense at this point than individual defense? I know it's kind of the same knock on Wiggins, but he seems to get – there are individual matchups where I think you look at him and he's just toast. But Towns, it doesn't seem to happen to as often, and I don't really know how to view that anymore. I think it's good that you can count on him fairly often when he's as an individual defender. But at this point, is it encouraging that that's the problem, or is it just discouraging because, hey, this is year four, this is year three with Thibodeau?
Well, I think with big men, too, I think it just takes a little bit longer. I mean, in the past, we've seen it take big men until they're mid to late 20s, so they're 27, 28 years old, to really round into being, you know, good to great defenders. And I think it's just a hard position to learn, and especially now, you know, with big men being able to do so much. I mean, like we've talked about with Towns here in this conversation, he can shoot outside. He can, you know, drive with the ball. I mean, there's just so much he can face up. He can put whatever it is. A lot of these big men can do so much. And I think that's just changed so much that he might have more responsibilities that were considered for wings or guards in the past that now big men are being expected to do.
And that's kind of there are just bigs who've probably warped our perception of how we view bigs. It's sort of like the so let's look at Carmelo Anthony right now, where people are just talking about how washed he is and just how terrible he is and stuff like that. It's like, well, he's in his age 34 season, I think.
He's done like 16 seasons.
Right, and it's like not everybody's LeBron. It's not like Dwayne Wade was an All-NBA player when he was when he was that age, at age 34, excuse me, I don't know why I'm getting so tongue twisted right now. And it might be the same way with Towns. Not everyone's going to be Anthony Davis on defense. He's legitimately just a 20 foot wing. Like, that's just what Anthony Davis is, and that's not Towns.
No, Anthony Davis, it'd be like saying, you know, going through, like, yeah, well, he's fine, but he's not Wilt Chamberlain. Like, players like Anthony Davis and these kind of, I don't want to say freaks, they're like anomalies or aberrations, you know, they shouldn't be expected to be the rule.
Right. And I get that that's their ideal archetypes, but not every great player is going to be that. And again, I do think that that warps just perception all around, you know, whether it's people who cover the team individually or just people like me who are watching them from afar. That's something that I think everyone at some point is just guilty of. You know, it's like the search for the next Draymond Green at one point seemed to be an obsession. It probably still is an obsession. Not everyone's going to be that.
That undersized utility forward that can do everything.
Well, I guess Zion Williamson's gonna sort of continue that trend and make people fall in love with it even more, maybe. So who knows? Is there for the Timberwolves, is Tibbs going to, I guess this dovetails with one, will he be there next season? But do you think that he should be? Like, that this is, you know, because this happened midseason, I know it was his choice to move Jimmy Butler, but all these changes are happening. You're not really going to get a training camp to integrate, but you're not really, you're actually not getting a training camp to integrate all these new players. Don't know why I phrased it that way. Does he deserve some sort of a grace period? Is this a situation he brought on to himself? And I'm not one to defend Tibbs. I will say, though, that we can't look back at the Jimmy Butler trade, acquiring him from Chicago, as a mistake, because that was a deal that everyone thought they fleeced Chicago on. It had those vibes of when the Thunder got Paul George and no one thought Victor Oladipo was going to be worth his contract. And hindsight is a luxury, but we can't use it as a crutch because, again, that was just a clear-cut, great move at the time. And I'm wondering if, because of what's happened and how midstream the changes are undergoing, that he's going to deserve a little bit more time than maybe he actually gets or that people outside want to give him. Or is it just, hey, you kind of knew this team was headed down a slippery slope leading into the offseason, you didn't deal with it, and maybe this isn't the situation for him when you have these two young guys on max deals and where this team might be in a situation where I don't want to say they're going to go a full-on rebuild just because, again, Wiggins and Towns are on those max deals, but to where they might have to go through a year or two of transition.
Yeah, and I mean, my thing with this situation has been that he's really, well, I mean, you give him credit for, you know, say, oh, yeah, well, you know, he got a nice return for Jimmy Butler and this or that. But he kind of put them in the situation to dig himself out of. And there was definitely a little bit of, you know, malpractice going into this with, right. You know, if he knew, the earliest that we figure he knew was Jimmy Butler said that he told Tibbs that he wanted out 4 days after the season. Well, if that was 4 days after the Rockets series, that's April. 4 days after the finals, that's June. 4 days after the calendar year, that's right after the 4th of July. So at best, he knew 2 or 3 months before Jimmy made his trade demand public and really allowed this to fester. And he didn't take any action to discourage Butler from doing the things that he did when he came ranting and raving into practice and cursing out management and all these things. You know, he really seemed to encourage and invite it. And I do think that's a mishandling. And I think anything that, you know, would do something to alienate Karl Anthony Towns is also a hindrance. And I don't think that owner Glenn Taylor is off the hook for any of this either in the way that he's handled this. But it does at least sound like Scott Layden is now doing more general manager type things for an interview that Taylor gave with The Athletic. And that Tom Thibodeau is focusing more on coaching now than in the past. So I think we're already seeing that rule and that shift because we've seen how long these dual roles last, and they don't usually last long and they don't go well. And yeah, I don't think the Jimmy Butler trade, I think you'd make that every single time. It's, you know, maybe it's something to be said for how we evaluate trades too quickly. But that deal was universally celebrated at the time. And I think some of the best trades are the ones where you feel like, yeah, they gave up something and we gave up something and, you know, it worked out for everyone in the end because ultimately the goal is to win more games, get back to the playoffs and get Towns and Wiggins some experience and hopefully that they're better for that. As for next season, I really do feel like he has to make the playoffs this season.
Wow.
Or I would hope at least that he would. But I mean, in this Western Conference, there's not a lot of time for catch up and you do need to turn that around. But then again, with Glenn Taylor, it's hard to know. I mean, he has a track record, whether it's Randy Whitman or Kevin McHale, of hanging on to guys a little too long. And yet the funny thing is, you know, he cut bait with Flip Saunders when he was 500, Dwayne Casey when he was 500 as head coach. So he doesn't really have the best track record in evaluating personnel and the people that he puts in place. So it'll be, I mean, sure you could add David Kahn into that mix of guys that he kept around too long. So He's really a wild card in the situation where you don't know how he's quite going to handle this.
You talk about making up ground in the West, and it's ridiculous that I'm saying this, but they're leading into their game against the Blazers. They're 2.5 games back of the 8 seed. And one, the 8 seed is the Sacramento Kings, which, whoa. But that 2.5 games, even this early in the season, even knowing who the team is that's holding it, when you look at who's in front of them in the standings but out of the playoffs, like the Spurs, the Jazz, the Pelicans, the Rockets, again, we're dealing with 14, 15 game samples. That mountain just seems so hard to climb, and those 2.5 games, even this early, feel close to, if not entirely insurmountable.
Yeah, it's the crazy thing, and I think it's funny in the past, like people have talked about, oh, the NBA doesn't matter until Christmas, and it's like, well, a big reason the Wolves made the playoffs last season was that they had the tiebreaker locked up with the Thunder before New Year's Day. They had all but locked up a playoff tiebreaker with the Pelicans and were in other advantage situations that paid off. So even though they slid after Jimmy went down last season, they were really able to keep their heads above water and remain in the race despite all the losses that they had because they took care of business early on. And that's why that loss in Portland hurts so much and why tonight's game against Portland is so critical is that all these divisional and conference games matter when you're a potential playoff team. And right now for 13, 14 teams, I mean, in the West, like all of these games matter. You know, anytime these teams play each other, aside from Phoenix, and I think eventually Dallas will come back to earth. But yeah, it's really hard to see that, you know, making that up very easily, unless, you know, there are going to be circumstances, of course, injuries and slumps and things like that. And they're going to be opportunistic and do everything that they can. And they, what really needs to happen is that the Wolves need to start winning away from Target Center. They have a five, they're in a, the three more games in this five game homestand, but they are winless on the road this season. And while they're not going to lose every single game, they need to start getting some success away from Target Center to supplement all those home wins.
Yeah. 0-8 away from Target Center leading into their game against the Blazers. And when they're on the road, they're being outscored by 10.8 points per 100 possessions, which is not good. Do you view, and it's nice that you sort of confirmed this, and I think it was hinted at with the way the Jimmy Butler trade unfolded. Woj had mentioned in his article that the deal was almost brokered at the ownership level between Josh Harris and Glenn Taylor. Do you view that as a red flag for Tibbs' future? And do you expect him then to be there next season? Because if it's playoffs, if the mandate is playoffs or you're gone, I don't think the Timberwolves are going to make the playoffs. And it's going to be even harder. I know there will be, I think the Kings are going to fall back down to earth. There will always be a surprise or two tanker as the season goes on. But if the Mavericks are going to hang around like close to 500, if we're talking about the Spurs, who are not a clear-cut playoff team, but we know that they're going to try the entire season to make that postseason race, it's just going to get so much harder, and it's really difficult for me to believe that Minnesota, if they go full bore the entire season, they might still end up on the fringes of it, but I just don't know that I see a path outside other teams really fading or an injury, or, again, it would have to be like a team in the Pelicans, not the Pelicans are a bad example, but the Grizzlies situation where they fall off and they decide, hey, we're going to kind of bottom out like once again this season to try and keep our pick. And if it is, again, going to be get to the playoffs or you're gone, it's really hard for me then to envision that Tibbs would be in Minnesota next year.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad you brought up the Grizzlies because, you know, we think about how bad they were last season, but they really didn't have Conley and Gasol for the entire season. So it's really as if they added two of the best players at their positions in the NBA this season. And I mean, I think that you have a legitimate point guard, you have a legitimate center who can do a lot of things. And I think that makes it easy to construct a younger roster around them. So, I mean, they could even be for real. But the big issue with a lot of frustrations a lot of the teams had in dealing with the Wolves front office when it came to the Jimmy Butler trade was knowing who to talk to. There was such a lack of communication, or I guess they weren't getting calls back, or they didn't know who they should be calling. So I think separating the roles of general manager and coach for Tom Thibodeau should help that a little bit. And I think that might've been part of why Glenn Taylor had to get involved and kind of broker that deal himself, as you said. But I don't know, too, how much that was that teams just got a sense that Tom Thibodeau wasn't really interested in trading Jimmy Butler until the Kings game last Friday, when he just got fed up enough and said, well, this isn't good. You know, when Jimmy was about to lay down his final ultimatum, and then Tibbs decided that he had had enough. And it's like, if you had ever, having spent time around Jimmy, I've never gotten the sense that he's the kind of guy who hides his feelings, says what he doesn't mean, like, you know what Jimmy Butler's thinking. For instance, there was one game last season where he was big in closing out the game and played incredibly well. And it was a Friday night, and he comes in, he's like, oh, I'm not talking to you guys. And he goes up to the shower. He comes back, he gets dressed and leaves. And one of the other reporters goes, wait, he's not going to talk? It's like, I didn't think he was kidding. I mean, there's nothing about Jimmy Butler that makes it seem like.
Yeah, at least he gave you a heads up. A lot of players wouldn't have even given you the heads up.
It would have been, oh, a few more minutes. Oh, I got to do this. I got to do that. And yeah, he just got dressed and walked out. I mean, Jimmy Butler is very Jimmy Butler. And I don't know how someone who's been around him as much as Tom Thibodeau has, you know, thought that he could change his mind by having him play more with the team that, you know, he hates playing for.
And I promise I'll get you out of here on these kind of two thoughts / questions. With Taylor sort of taking over more of the, or at least knowing that Thibodeau might have less, I don't want to say, but control over the basketball operations side of this team, if the Wolves do fall out of the playoff race semi early on, again, if it becomes a third of the season well before the All-Star break, they don't have a ton of pieces to sell off. Could you see them holding a quasi fire sale where maybe they're or maybe it's even over the offseason where maybe they could look at rerouting Robert Covington, because while he's on a great contract and he's not super old, does he fit the timeline for a rebuild? Or do you think, Tibbs or no Tibbs, that and whether this season becomes, for lack of a better phrase, a lost cause, that they're going to try and just regroup and make a playoff push next year, again, regardless of who the coach is at that point?
Well, that's the thing, right? You know, this team, they've had been bad for so long, and Glenn Taylor's owned this team for almost, you know, 25 years at this point. I think this is actually year 25. Wow.
Wow.
And so I do think that he really wants to see another long-term winner in Minnesota, like he had in the Kevin Garnett, Flip Saunders days early on. So I don't think that they want to go that route after being through so many, because I mean, just after KG, you can think there's the Al Jefferson era, the Kevin Love era, you know, into the Andrew Wiggins, Karl Anthony Towns era that we're in now. So I mean, there's just been so much change, and I think just to overhaul that again and hit reset, even though you have, you know, these guys under contract, is probably an unenviable situation to be in. I mean, I don't think that Robert Covington should be a player that's, you know, off limits or untouchable. Of course, if you get a great offer that the team's better for, I do think that you have to look at stuff like that. But I do imagine that they would still try to be competitive and try to keep as many pieces intact, especially if you're not keeping Tom Thibodeau beyond this season and having as much of an appealing roster to sell to potential coaching candidates for next season. I do think there's something in that, but like you said, they don't have a lot of pieces to sell off. Tyus Jones is a restricted free agent. And I mean, if teams want him, they can try to make a play for him there. I mean, assuming they have the cap space, but most teams will. Gorgui Dieng, they've tried to move that contract, but you know, they
I'm
might
still have a believer, by the way, in case that matters.
Oh, and Gorgui?
Yeah.
I like Gorgui. I think he can do a lot of things. And I think, not to get on a tangent here, but I wrote about this last season, how he just needs to play. I mean, he's one of those guys, I think, that needs a feel for the game, and playing 15 minutes throughout a game throughout his whole career has not worked out for him. He's at his best when he's in that 20, 24 minute range. So I think he does need to be getting a better feel for the game. But at this point, I do think they would probably need to attach a pick to that. And I don't know that that's the smartest move. And we saw how unwilling the team was to do that last season, especially knowing that their pick was likely headed to Atlanta and they were going to be getting the Oklahoma City pick.
I mean, hey, until this season, the three previous season, Gorgui Dieng was shooting 44% on long twos, and it looked like he was going to have some semblance of a three-point clip. He's taking them this year. I'm not out on Gorgui Dieng yet. That price point is obviously difficult, but I root for chaos as someone who doesn't have to cover a certain team.
Oh, and yeah.
It would be really hysterical to me if Draymond Green qualifies for the Supermax this year, extension this year, the Warriors don't want to pay him, Tibbs is still in Minnesota, and then tries to use basically the same framework of the return he got for Jimmy Butler to acquire Draymond Green from Golden State. How do you feel about that?
Oh, his game is going to age so poorly when he gets old.
And that's the thing, though, is that you could trade for him and know you're going to keep him, because he seems, especially after taking a discount in that last contract, he seems like he wants to get paid, in the sense that someone's going to give me, if I'm on their team, a 5-year max, or they're going to give me a 4-year max, and people don't think I'm worth that outside the Warriors. And that would be if Tibbs has a say, and even if Glenn Taylor's really interested in just winning immediately, to know that you could get Draymond Green and that he probably wouldn't leave if you're willing to give him the full boat, that would just be, you know, and I don't know how the Warriors would view an offer built around Covington and Sarge for Green. I would think they would actually probably be intrigued in that situation, depending on what happens with Kevin Durant and free agency, obviously. But that's my dream right now. That's the offseason storyline I want to see unfold.
Oh, yeah, that would be something.
And so Tyus Jones, Taz Gibson, Derrick Rose, this is actually my last question. Who among them are back next season?
Oh, wow, the Taj question is interesting. I can't decide on that. I could see him going somewhere else at this point, especially if Tom Thibodeau is gone. I mean, because he's up after this season. Restricted free agents like Tyus Jones, we don't really ever know how those are going to play out anymore, right?
We should probably ask Phoenix.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. Oh, yeah, Phoenix is going to do something crazy. That's going to happen. Yeah, it's, you know, I think Tyus might ultimately like to be somewhere else. I do think he likes playing in Minnesota. I do think he likes playing where he grew up. But I do think that there's just so much. I guess you really have to know who's coaching this team to figure out.
That's fair.
You know, who they want. Because you could also say, oh, Derrick Rose will be back, or he won't be back, depending if Tom Thibodeau is the head coach. Because, I mean, if you figure even if Rose does come back under a new head coach, the role will probably be slightly different. Or they might like Tyus more. There's a lot there. I guess of the three, I don't feel as strongly about Taj being back. And that's not based off anything that I know. It's just kind of a general feel that I get.
If you have Saric, I don't know. Unless he's coming back at a really steep discount and going to come off the bench, I don't know that. And even then, I really want to see, and I don't know if we will ever see, but a Karl Anthony Towns at the 5, Wiggins at the 4, Covington at the 3 type lineups. And long term, and that kind of, if you have Saric as well and Gibson, that impedes the path to that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and Taj Gibson and Gorgui Dieng, I mean, they kind of do similar things in the sense that they don't really stretch the floor a ton. They can grab some boards and things like that. You know what they kind of do, although I think Taj is a better defender. Like, they're kind of that same archetype that, you know, we talk about for like a big man in the league, even though I do think Taj Gibson's a slightly better player. I just don't know that they do enough to differentiate themselves, and there's kind of some redundancies between the two. And if you're not moving the Gorgui deal, do you really need Taj? Especially when you're going to have all your picks this year. So, yeah, I'm not too sure on that one.
If the Wolves do have a playoff race before the trade deadline, they might want to look at moving Teague, because I assume that you think he'll exercise his player option, and maybe a team like the Suns is willing to give you filler and they seem like they're out on Josh Jackson or just something along those lines, help you improve your pick. And it does seem like you're not going to want for options at point guard. If Tibbs is still there, Derrick Rose probably still comes cheap. I still like Tyus Jones. I like Jeff Teague as well, but that to have him, if you're not going to be a bona fide playoff team, is also an odd fit.
That deal doesn't make sense on a non-playoff team.
But yeah, unless you have anything else to add, that's really, you satisfied all my questions on the Timberwolves. So I really do appreciate that.
No, I think it's been a great conversation.
Everyone should be following Derek on Twitter if they are not already. Again, I want to thank him for giving me 50 plus minutes of his time. I hope you enjoyed this look into the Timberwolves. Derek's Twitter handle again is @DerekJamesNBA. Derek is spelled D-E-R-E-K for people who might be wondering. You can follow me on Twitter @DanFavalle, F-A-V-A-L-E. Follow Andy on Twitter @AndrewDBailey, spelled like it sounds. Hardwood Knox is @HardwoodKnox. Our parent site, NBA Math, is @NBA_math. Please, again, continue to rate, review, subscribe to us on iTunes. If you've already done all that, steal people's phones, do it for them, or preferably recommend us to them. Maybe they really like crappy basketball takes and they'll enjoy this podcast. But again, we want to thank Derek once more. And until next time, I leave everyone with the shout out to the one, the only Kyle Anderson.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in the new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series premiering Sunday, June 6th, only on Showtime.